Hi, I'm Rayburn Johnson.
And I'm Steve Sensenig.
And this is Beyond the Box.
Here's your invitation to explore life outside the box of institutional religion.
This is a place where there are no walls to restrict our search for truth as we embrace the ambiguity of defining our life in Christ.
So unbuckle your seatbelt,
recline your chair,
throw caution to the wind, and get ready for the ride that is
Beyond the Box.
Welcome back to Beyond the Box. If you have not listened to part one,
shame on you. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. What's your problem? If you've not listened to Ray's part one of his interview with Sharon Baker, I encourage you to go listen to that right now. Just click stop on your MP3 player and go listen to that before you go any further. We are doing something brand new here on Beyond the Box, and that's an outside interview with somebody that's not Ray or me. and as we explained last time, just for strictly pragmatic reasons, Ray did this solo without me. But what a fun interview to listen to, Ray. I really enjoyed part one and eager to share part two with our listeners. As a brief recap, you don't have to go into as much detail, but tell us again just briefly who Sharon Baker is and what we're about to hear in this part of the interview, Ray.
Well, Dr. Sharon Baker is assistant professor of theology. She's written a book entitled Raising Hell, which is not only raised hell in the R-A-Z-I-N-G sense, but it's raised a lot of hell
but
for
it has
her.
Raised hell in evangelical circles.
She's taken a lot of, I think she's had some.
Taking a lot of heat, yeah.
She's taken some heat from the book from more conservative folks. And,
yeah.
But anyway, she's not only written that book, she's also written a lot of scholarly essays and entries. There's a fantastic book entitled Stricken by God? Which is edited by Brad Jerzak, which has scholars from everyone from N.T. Wright to Marcus Borg and in between is in that book.
Wow.
Writing an essay about understanding the atonement through a nonviolent lens.
I've got to get that book.
I tell you, when I read her essay, and I know I said this before, but her essay really registered with me more than anyone else's, the way that she fits justice and the atonement together and re-understanding God through the lens of nonviolence.
And last time you guys talked about that in the last episode, and boy, some fascinating thoughts about justice and forgiveness.
Yeah.
And what that really means. It wasn't necessarily that it was new material for me, Ray, but she just said it in a way that made it feel fresh to me.
Yeah, she just, I think what it is, Steve, is, you know, when you bring someone in that you're not used to talking to, and of course she's had training that you and I haven't, and has probably thought some things through that maybe we've not thought about.
And she said she's probably forgotten most of it too.
Exactly. She's probably forgot more than I'll know, but you know, that
that's not what she said. Come on.
No, she didn't say that. I'm saying that. But, you know, the thing is when you bring a fresh voice to the table, and this is what is so important to you and I about dialogue versus monologue,
yes.
When you bring a fresh voice to the table, you get a whole new perspective. And for us, you know, being two white, middle-class American men, to actually have a female voice come in and to share some different perspectives on things like the atonement and even the social violence that can occur in light of what we believe just about the cross and how we can oppress women and we can oppress minorities and all of these different things simply by what we believe about God and the atonement. That's enlightening to me. And I think it helps kind of not only balance our conversation out, but like you said in the last episode, I think she's taken it farther in some areas than you and I have even gone. So... And
it
we
was
thought
so
we went
refreshing.
Pretty far down.
Exactly. Well, that's what I was going to say. It was so refreshing because I feel so often like we're pushing those boundaries so hard. And to hear somebody come along and say, oh, yeah,
exactly.
Of course. You know, I mean, it just was very refreshing to me. And I have to say this with regard to what you just said about women and having a female voice come into the podcast. if we were to silence female voices like some Christians feel like we should, I think Christianity would lose a tremendously valuable voice in Sharon Baker.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, I not having known anything about her prior to you scheduling this interview and still not knowing a huge amount of about her other than what I've heard in your interview with her, I am incredibly grateful for Sharon Baker and for what she brings to the table. And having said that, I again want to just get out of the way and let you finish this interview with her and bring this to our listeners' ears, because you guys are in for a real treat as we conclude this interview that Ray did with Sharon Baker. Listen and enjoy.
I think I hear the roller coaster coming. You talk about with atonement, something that's really intrigued me lately. I've just recently in the last year or so become more familiar with the Eastern Orthodox idea of theosis.
Oh, yeah.
And the idea that we become partakers of the divine nature and that the life of Christ is actually the saving event. Yeah. You talk about that in your book and how you seem to kind of, you feel like that is more of a faithful interpretation of what was going on than the Western tradition from Augustine and beyond. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, when you think about verses like "it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives within me," or in Galatians, "I die daily," and that is so that Christ can be more alive in you, have this attitude in yourselves which was in Christ Jesus, and then it goes on to talk about how we're supposed to treat people. Then the John 15, we actually dwell in Christ. And when you take into consideration Eastern philosophy and Buddhism and some of these Eastern traditions, which was pretty close to some of the thought in the Middle East during the time of Jesus and afterwards and before, you think about that as an Eastern theology is very much focused on oneness, being one with God, in unity with God, being brought up into the Godhead and living the divine life. God became human so humans could become God. And I'm not saying we become God. We're not deified, but we do take in, we are taken up into the divine life or the life of the divine. And when you think about atonement, the word itself was a word coined way back by what's his name?
William Tyndale, is that?
Thank you, William Tyndale. Although it was used before him, but he's the one who gets all the credit for it. But at one meant. Mm. And so if you sum up my theology of the cross anyway, that's what it is. It's at one meant. Jesus made it possible for us to be at one with God.
Wow.
That we are no longer who we are, but we are who God is, and we live like God would have us live, or the way God would live here on earth. And it's an incarnational kind of theology, and it's beautiful. And we've sort of lost that. We've got this huge separation between human and divine in the Western tradition, where humans are just autonomous, and we are if we're living outside of the divine life.
Right.
But salvation itself, when we grasp onto that reconciliation, it's a reconciliation of souls and spirits and hearts that become one. The psalmist prays, "Lord, give me an undivided heart." He wants a heart that's one with God's heart.
Wow.
And that's all metaphorical language, of course, but we don't have any other way to talk about it. And
well, I mean, how could you literally describe being one with God? I mean,
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's more and more I'm beginning to see that we have really short-sold salvation to where it's about getting a ticket to the afterlife, to heaven, eternity.
Fire insurance, yeah.
Yeah, it's fire insurance. And when you talk about something like theosis, that is such a high view of what salvation is.
Oh,
the
it
fact
is.
That what you just said, that we're taken up into the community. I mean, we're taken into the community of the Trinity.
Yeah.
That's mind-boggling.
We're included.
That's just mind-boggling. That has huge implications.
God is inclusive. It's not, hey, I've got my two buds here in the Trinity. I've got, you know, the Son and the Spirit here, so y'all stay out. But God actually loves us enough to take us up into
the divine. Really, if you think about it, Sharon, that's where we came from. If God breathed into Adam the breath of life, was the Spirit, then really we're just returning to where we came from.
That's right.
Wow.
The body goes to dust, the Spirit goes to God. And it's a beautiful thing. And it's unfortunate that we have made the good news something else.
Yeah, it's not very good.
It's not good news. And I want to make the good news again, not only to draw people into the life of God, but also to change our image of God so that we can start behaving less violently. I was talking to my cousin last week. He's very much not liking this Raising Hell book. He's a very, very conservative Christian. And he would, we'd be talking about life or something, and he'd say, well, it doesn't matter. There is no hell.
Huh.
Well, it doesn't matter if we do that, because there's no hell, right?
Wow.
And I didn't say it to him because I didn't want to get into it with him, but I wanted to say that's so sad.
Yeah.
I tell students that, because they'll say, well, wait, if there's no hell, well, I'm not saying there's no hell. I'm just raising it up to the level of God, where
you're
God,
R-A-I-S-I-N-G instead of R-A-Z-I-N-G.
Yeah, I'm doing both, in both senses of the word. I'm raising R-A-Z-I-N-G, the traditional theories, and raising R-A-I-S-I-N-G up to the realm of the presence of God and the love of God, is fiery love. But anyway, I wanted to say that's so sad that we have made the good news this escape from a tyrant God, when really what salvation is about and our motivation for salvation shouldn't be get out of hell free card. It should be this love of God that we see through Jesus that we want to so be a part of, that our being a part of it not only takes us up into the life of the very God, God's self, but also reveals that image of God through us on earth, that we can actually transform the world and make it a place where God would want it, you know, the way God would want it to be, a place of peace and of love and of inclusivity. And when you look at what the image of God means, when you read that in Genesis, you look at the history surrounding the area, you know, when these things were put into words, and you think about Babylon and some of those kingdoms. What that meant was that word is a word they used for when a king would go out to a different province. He had castles or, you know, palaces in different provinces. But when he left one province or one castle, he would have this image struck out of metal that was extremely shiny. And it would be posted on the castle so that all the people around, because they were always afraid people were going to usurp their kingdoms, you know, in those days.
Right.
They had to be careful. They leave one place, better watch it. Someone's going to come in and take over for you.
You come back, you're not king anymore.
Yeah, right. So they would cast these metal images that would shine in the sun when the sunlight hit them. And anybody who wanted to know where the king was would look up. Well, if that wasn't there, they'd know he was in the castle. But if that image was shining brightly in the sun, they could look up and say, okay, he's not there, but he's present even though he's absent.
Huh.
The image shone there in the sun, so they would know the king was really here even though he's bodily absent.
Wow.
And when we're made in that image, it's like God is saying, I'm present in you, even though it looks as though I'm absent.
Wow.
And
wow.
So how are we reflecting God?
Wow. So in being image bearers, it's just as if the king was here.
Right.
He's just living his life through us. It's not
exactly.
I, like you said earlier with Theosis, it's not I who live, but Christ who lives in me.
That's right.
Wow. That's amazing.
And if we are one with God,
yeah,
like Jesus said, I and the Father are one.
Wow. So when Jesus, it's kind of like Jesus telling Philip, you know, have you been with me so long and you don't even know that when you see me, you've seen the Father, what I say,
right,
what I do. So it's almost the same thing. God, you know, these are strong words and some people might have a problem with it, but it's really that the incarnation of God in humanity is repeated over and over and over through the church.
Yeah. The body of Christ.
Yeah, yeah, that we are the icon.
That's right.
The physical manifestation of God in the earth. Wow.
That's right.
It's amazing.
And we're really screwing it up.
We really are.
I am too. I mean, I'm not pointing
we,
fingers
no,
at it.
We, you said it, we.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, you know, it's like Stanley Hauerwas said, you know, the reason I believe in nonviolence is because I'm a violent SOB, you know? I mean,
yeah,
that's,
right. Yeah, he
I mean, that's really what it comes down to, you know?
It is. Yeah,
that's we're the ones who need it because uh-huh. we recognize the only difference between you and I and anyone else is that we recognize it and we think it's a problem.
Right.
Yeah, that's really the only difference.
And so, if I were gonna, that's my motivation for writing, Raising Hell and the different articles, and now this Atonement book is, I want the image of God in our conceptual image of God. To be such that the image of God in us lives itself out in the world in a nonviolent way.
Yeah, that's good. I think that's God's goal. I really do. I think that's God's goal. So we talked about justice. We've talked about atonement, and I think all these things are naturally leading to talk about hell, because your book, after all, is titled "Raising Hell."
Yeah.
You know, so many people we've. Really, just recently, I think it's been just the last few months, we did, well, after the Rob Bell book came out, you know, all the huge controversy
Love
that
wins.
Was, over Love Wins.
Yeah, I was wishing I could tap into some of that publicity.
Well, I was kind of thinking maybe you might. I was going to ask you about that, if that had affected your book sales at all.
It did somewhat, but I don't think he even knows it's out there. It would have been a nice thing for him to have read before he wrote his book.
Well, and don't get me wrong, I love Rob Bell, and I think Rob Bell's...
Oh, he's great, yeah.
I really enjoyed his stuff. But there's so many people that, like I say, me working at a bookstore, so many people that come in and want to read Rob Bell's book, and they're interested. And even though I really like Love Wins, Rob Bell's a very enigmatic person, and he mm-hmm. purposefully does that to, you know, just try and get you thinking. He's not trying to make conclusive statements. Mm-hmm. So I'm intentionally steering people to stuff like your book and, you know, Brad Jerzak and Tom Talbot and those guys, because I feel like people get a much more thorough view of, you know, what does it mean to believe in an alternative view of hell.
Right.
You talk about in your book that a lot of the language of hell in the New Testament is metaphorical.
Mm-hmm.
We've taken the fires and the gnashing of teeth and all of these kind of things as very literal. And a lot of that we base on, you know, the parable of Jesus with the rich man and Lazarus and mm-hmm. just a lot of the different things Jesus says. What are some examples of where we've missed the boat on taking language that's meant to be metaphor and hyperbole and taking that literally? What are some examples of that? I'm catching you on the spot here.
You mean examples from the Bible or examples in our own life?
What are some examples from the New Testament, do you think, like where we, if the language of the New Testament on hell is predominantly metaphorical, what's some examples maybe that Jesus said or that John said that that we should be taking metaphorical where maybe we've taken them literally, like the weeping and gnashing of teeth and the sheep and the goats and all these kinds
of
things.
The outer darkness.
Yeah, exactly. Where are some of those things? How do you, in coming to the conclusion that they're metaphorical, how do you get there?
Well, again, it's a matter of looking at what the people, if we can, we can't do this. We can't get there, but we can try as best we can to try to figure out what the people at that time heard when Jesus said those words. And so you go back and you study Gehenna. There's no word for hell the way we conceive of it really in the New Testament or the Old. But Gehenna is one of the words used most often. And so what was Gehenna? It was a garbage dump outside the walls of Jerusalem.
Right.
Where for millennia, that's where dead bodies were thrown. That's where way back human sacrifices were committed, performed for these other religious traditions. They threw their garbage there. It was a horrible place. And so Jesus is using a common metaphor in order to talk about something that otherwise people couldn't understand. So you've got metaphor going where he's referring to a garbage dump that was a place nobody wanted to spend much time. You know, the fire would smolder underneath because they'd burn the garbage and sometimes the dead bodies, whatever, way back. where it would smolder and smolder. And you know how a fire smolders underneath and it looks
right.
like it's not burning on top, but it is underneath. And as the stuff on top gradually gets stuff thrown on top of it, it reaches this smoldering place. So the fire never, ever, ever goes out. It's unquenchable.
Wow.
And at the same time, whenever you dump garbage, what do you have? You've got maggots. So there's always worms, you know, the maggots, they never seem to die. They're always there feeding on the stuff that's been thrown on most recently. So you've got these worms that never die, this fire that's never quenched. The place stinks like hell, and it's just this horrible spot where you, you know, plug your nose and throw the stuff without getting very close and hoping you got a good arm and you landed on the heap. But and it's just this place, and Jesus is saying that's what it's going to be like for you if you don't listen to what I'm saying. So you've got metaphor going. It was outside the city, you know, so it was considered like the outer darkness. But then you've got hyperbole at work, too. And one of the things that we see Jesus using quite often is hyperbole. Another example would be he requires us to hate our mother, those who do not hate your mother, your father, your sister, your
right.
friend. Well, we have no problem saying that's hyperbole, that's metaphorical. Yet when it comes to these other places where Jesus is using metaphor, obviously, and hyperbole, obviously, in order to get our attention, we say, no, we have to take that literally. And
wow.
I don't understand that mindset. So Jesus is saying something that is purposely trying to shock his hearers into saying, whoa, I need to follow Jesus. I need to get back to God. Does he mean it literally? Well, no, of course not. You know, you're not going to spend your time thrown outside the walls of Jerusalem, burning forever in the garbage heap. The Hinnon Valley, actually, Gehenna.
That was one thing that Brad Jerzak, have you read the book Her Gates Will Never Be Shut?
No,
Brad
I didn't read that.
It's a good book, but he basically does a lot of talk about Gehenna and the different concepts of hell from the Old Testament and this kind of thing. But anyway, one of the things that he brought out that just really, I just really boggled my mind was how he talked about, you know, Gehenna, like you said, it was the Valley of the Sons of Hinnom.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about how in Jeremiah, God actually tells the people that they're getting ready to be destroyed. I think it's by Babylon because they're burning their children in the Valley of Hinnom.
Yeah.
And how ironic is it? And he actually goes on to say, which is a thing that I would never even enter my heart to do.
Mm-hmm.
How ironic is it that we have taken a place, Gehenna, that God says, that God rebukes them for burning their children in there and says, I would never even think about doing such a thing,
right.
and converted that into a doctrine that says that's exactly what God will do for eternity with most people.
Right.
It's just really,
it really
doesn't make sense. So I'm with you. I think a lot of the language, I think it is metaphorical. I'm more and more seeing that even though I've grown up with this, like I say, literalistic background, mm-hmm. that while we say we believe everything literally, it's really double talk because the example you gave of hating your mother and father, I never met a good Baptist who hated their mother and father.
No, in fact, we're taught to honor our mother and father. So
exactly.
There's this inconsistency, you know, in the Old Testament, but in Ephesians.
Yeah, yeah.
Obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. That's the first verse I had my children memorize.
Good call. and you emphasize that part probably about, which comes with a promise that you're going to have a long life, because if you don't,
yeah,
I brought you in this
them.
World, I could take
These
you
the
out of this world.
And then one of my sons says back to me, well, Mom, why do we want a long life if when we die we go be with God?
Oh, wow.
Well,
boy, that makes you want to rethink your image of God, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. That's so true. You know, so many people don't want anything to do with God. And the idea of actually being with God is scary because of all the things we've talked about. So
yeah, right.
When you've got, you know, children coming to you and saying, God, why would I want to go be with him? You
yeah.
might want to rethink your theology at that point.
Uh-huh.
You talk about two words, a Greek word and a Hebrew word. And I am neither a Greek nor Hebrew person.
Oh, for eternity.
What's that?
For eternity.
Yes, the two for eternity. Is it eon and olam? Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. How have we mistranslated these two words that, you know, you've said in the New Testament, that was the Greek word, and in the Old Testament, that was the Hebrew word for eternity. But
right.
yet, they don't mean that. What do they mean, and how have we mistranslated those?
Those words, sometimes when they refer to God, they're talking about forever and ever. But most always when they're used, they mean a certain length of time. For instance, Jonah was in the belly of the whale for olam, for eternity, forever. Well, we know maybe it felt like forever to him, but it was 3 days, you know, in this story. And I use other examples in the book that I can't recall to mind immediately, but most of the time when these words are used, they mean a certain length of time, a certain period of days. And it's, again, like we would say, gosh, I've been waiting here forever. Or I've been in line forever. Well, what do we mean by that? We mean we've been waiting in line for longer than we think we should have been waiting in line.
Wow.
And so it's the same use in both the Hebrew and in the Greek, where you see places where it's used a lot of places. There's no forever and ever, and you know, endlessness that we interpret it to mean. That eternal is not really eternal in the Greek and the Hebrew.
I remember one place you talked about was when it says this present age, and that's the same word that is eternity. So really we could have just as easily translated that this present eternity, which is totally
right.
Makes absolutely no sense.
Makes no sense. Yeah. You have a better memory than I do.
Well, I just got done reading the book again. So that is really big though, because that's so much of what we've built our doctrine of hell upon are those verses that talk about the eternal nature
punishment.
Of the punishment.
Yeah.
So basically would you say it's more saying, I think you said this in the book, a punishment that's fitting for the age to come versus an eternal punishment.
Right. And punishment is even not the right word.
I think it's suffering
the consequences of our actions.
Yeah.
And we know we all do that. We suffer the consequences of other people's actions too, but life brings natural consequences with it, which is how we try to teach our children, right? If you run out in the road, you're going to be hit by a car. Well, being hit by a car is not punishment. It's just what happens when you run out in front of one. There's consequences.
And in a parenthetical thought here, that's one of the reasons I have such a problem with spanking.
Yeah.
Because it's not a logical consequence. It's a violent punishment, but it's not a logical logical that if you hit your brother, the way we tell you that's wrong is to hit you.
Right, exactly. That keeps the cycle of violence in motion.
Exactly, exactly.
And now I'm not saying we let our kids do whatever they want, but there's other ways to train our children rather than this retributive violence.
Anselm, one of my favorite characters from history.
Yeah.
I say that with a chuckle. Anselm, for you guys out there that don't remember, he's the guy that basically made popular the satisfaction theory of the atonement, which led to the penal substitutionary theory. Anselm said that a sin against an infinite God is an infinite sin deserving of infinite punishment. And this is how many times I've heard the idea of hell being eternal or punishment after this life being eternal. That's one of the main ways, other than scripture, philosophically, that I've heard it defended. How would you respond to that?
I would say that does not compute. And a finite sin against an infinite God shouldn't equal infinite punishment. It should equal finite punishment. Now, an infinite sin committed by an infinite God might require infinite punishment if you've got that retributive mindset going. But how does a finite sin require infinite punishment? It doesn't make sense.
Mm.
And so it sounds good and it preaches really well.
Yeah.
But if we're going to think through it logically, it doesn't make sense. How could that be?
Yeah.
And if we want to make the punishment fit the crime, why would temporal sin result in eternal punishment?
Which that's the ironic thing, Sharon, is the people that hold to that Anselmian view that says that the infinite sin, or that a sin against an infinite God would demand infinite punishment, those are the same people that believe in retributive notions of justice,
right.
And retribution is based on the idea of the punishment fitting the crime.
That's right.
So it that even undermines retribution, it seems.
It does, yeah.
Wow. You talk a lot in the book about the role of fire in judgment and how we've misunderstood fire and how fire is actually a manifestation of the presence of God. This was something really new for me that just absolutely blew me away. Just thinking about the idea of God being, I never put these scriptures together before, God being a consuming fire and fire going out from his presence. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, we see, and this fire thing started, I did a search through all of scripture on fire and read all the verses that talked about fire and then isolated the ones that connect fire to God. And we see that God is a consuming fire. We see in Isaiah that fire surrounds God. The word for seraph, or the seraphim, which is a plural for seraph, is really the word for fire in Hebrew. Mm. And God is surrounded by that. God is this consuming fire, we're told in Hebrews. And then you see where this fire burns up wickedness, but it doesn't burn up the righteous.
Hmm.
It burns up stuff that's bad or evil or wicked and annihilates. I mean, it's gone.
Hmm.
But everything that's righteous, it leaves in their wake. That's why when it says in the Psalms, and it's somewhere in Isaiah too, where we walk through the fire, we'll not be burned. We walk through the flame and we'll not be scorched. Well, why? Because those are righteous people.
Wow.
Then you read in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, talks about whoever lays a foundation, lays upon the foundation of Jesus Christ. And then it says that no one lays a foundation other than that is Jesus Christ. And if we build upon the foundation with wood, hay, straw, gold, silver, precious stones, the work will become evident. And those who the work is burned up, which we would say with the wood, hay, and straw, will suffer loss. Those whose work remains through the fire will suffer reward. But the one who suffers loss will be saved, yet so as through fire.
Wow.
And so wow. Salvation occurs, but it's through this fire. And he's talking to Christians here.
Yeah.
And so we stand in this fiery presence of God where all that's wicked is burnt away. And people say, well, that's purgatory. Well, no, I'm purgatory. You know, they've only let Martin Luther out of purgatory a decade ago. So that lasts for quite a long time.
Man, so, I'm in trouble.
Yeah. So, you know, it's an instantaneous thing in the twinkling of an eye. I mean, how can we measure time? It's just a human category. But if you believe Immanuel Kant. So this happens, and what's left is righteous and pure. And for people who don't have Jesus standing next to them, and this is where I've got to really be careful, and I didn't write a whole lot about this, although that's another book on pluralism. But for now, let's just say that those who don't have Jesus standing next to them as an advocate or one standing in solidarity with them, it will be a painful, horrible, hellish. It'll be hell for them to go through
right.
this horrible, you know, having their sin totally exposed and then burnt away. It's not going to be a walk in the park. And so they're not taking a walk, in other words. They are coming face to face with the way they live their lives and their victims and the God who is love, who in spite of this sin loves anyway and then burns away the sin, which is redemptive.
Mm.
Some say, well, that's violent. Well, no, I don't think we can say that's violence.
Well, I think it's almost, it's almost that you, you know, it's, I can't think of a good example, but it's kind of like when you go into a person's house in Asia, you take your shoes off. Or
right.
if you meet a prince in an Arabic country, you know, you bow to them and you take your
right.
shoes off and you do all these different rituals. It's conforming to who God is. Your
right.
your being is being conformed to love so that evil, it's a painful thing because if you're an evil person, then a lot of who you are is melting away in the presence of God. in the presence of that consuming fire.
Right. But it's not a punishment and it's not a violence. It's a purification, which is what the word kippur anyway means. It means to cover, but it also is a word that talks about being purified.
Which is where we get our word atonement, right?
Right. Mm. That's where that's how we interpret that, we translate that word. And so it's like washing the dishes.
Mm.
And that's not an act of violence.
Mm.
Because we're making them clean.
Well, maybe surgery is a good example. Someone that has cancer, that you know, it looks like a violent or evil thing to cut them open and to, you know, remove that cancer and sew them back up and put them under anesthesia. But at the end of the day, to not do it is actually more evil.
It's evil. It's more violent because then they're going to die of this horrible death. So
Yeah. I really like that about fire. I think that makes so much sense of all of the use of fire throughout, especially the New Testament.
Yeah.
I mean, our God is a consuming fire. That scripture never really made sense to me until reading your book, really. You talked about Otto a little bit, and I'm not going to make you rehash that whole story, but he is kind of the character that you use to give kind of your view of what hell might be, kind of an imaginary character that you use to kind of, I know it's not a literal, it's not your literal view of hell.
His name was George at first.
Oh, wow. I like Otto better.
And the publisher made me change it. So.
I like Otto. George is, you know, just
that was
too
tongue in cheek though.
Oh, it took me a minute. I just got turned off on a few stations there.
I'm sorry.
Oh no, I'm just kidding. Oh,
but
wow.
I changed it.
But you know, that's what you talk about with Otto is here's this guy that looks like a Hitler or a Stalin. Someone that sent people off to war for, you know, not that there's ever just cause for war, but has sent them off to terribly unjust causes, has persecuted, tortured everything, people that you can imagine. Here's this guy, and he comes before God for judgment. What happens?
Well, he comes before God. He dies expecting the worst, knowing that God is going to get him because that's what he's always heard, and hates God for it, and is even too hateful and arrogant to be afraid, although down in there somewhere he's got to be afraid. And he stands there, and he comes into the presence of God, and it's this fire. And it's hot, but it's not a condemning fire like he expects. It's a totally unorthodox approach because this fire is love. It's the fiery presence of God's love, and he's immersed in this fiery presence. And he was hateful and arrogant, and he just knew he was going to be nailed by God. But as this fire begins to immerse, he becomes immersed in this fire, it's a presence of burning, consuming love, so extravagant and excessive. It's a searing force that allows him and motivates him to come face to face with the horrible sinfulness of his life and his person, who he is. And he comes face to face with this sin, and he realizes how terrible and how horrible it is. And at the same time, this fiery, consuming love is so extravagant and so unorthodox compared to what he expected, that it just consumes him, and it burns him, and it acts as his judge, even though it's love. It's judging him because in the face of such sin, he doesn't deserve such love. So the sin becomes more prevalent, and he's remorseful. He's inconsolably grief-stricken. Yet the fire begins, as it begins to burn more and more and more of the wickedness and the evil and the sin away. He's more and more pure, and that love, the hatred, turns to repentance, and the repentance turns to love, and he finally stands before God in total righteousness. And when God says to him, you know, will you enter, you know, you are forgiven, will you enter my kingdom, what is a purely righteous person going to say, yes or no?
Wow.
Well, I think yes, probably.
you leave the possibility after that story, you leave the possibility open that Otto might say no, simply because of libertarian free will and those kind of considerations. I wondered because I was thinking to myself, the more I read about Otto and what you said about the nature of forgiveness, the fact that forgiveness precedes repentance and not the other way around, and the fact that God consumes all evil in that fire. Would you say that you would believe in ultimate reconciliation or ultimate redemption then?
Yeah, and what I didn't want to say in the book, I wanted to leave options open for people, so I gave an option of he could say no because we really don't know. So I wanted plausible options open, even in my own way of thinking. If a person would say no, that means there's no righteousness at all, and so it's annihilation, basically. That all they are is wicked, and so it's burnt up. I don't believe that. I don't believe that would happen. That because we're made and created in the image of God, there is something righteous buried under all of that sinfulness.
The image of God is still there somewhere.
Still there somewhere. Yeah, I don't believe that it's just totally gone, and so that would be left over. And then it's a different. And I didn't want to get into this as much in the book. I may do it in the Atonement book, but freedom is freedom from sin. We misinterpret, I think, freedom. We think freedom is I can choose whatever I want. When the biblical concept of freedom is we're free from sin. We're free from slavery to sin, and therefore free to choose God. And I think that the freedom to choose God would kick in after all the wickedness was burnt away. And everyone, every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God. So I would call myself, and I didn't have the nerve to do this in the book.
Sure.
I have other things I have to consider at the same time because people don't like heretics, especially if they teach at a Christian college. And so,
especially.
So I have come out of the closet, and I am a Christian universalist. I think that every knee, that the cross, God is powerful enough, and the cross of Christ, the life, death, and resurrection of Christ, is effective enough that at the end, every knee will bow and every tongue confess Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. I don't think the devil wins. I think the scoreboard is going to have zero on the devil's side.
Yeah, I agree. It's taken me a long time to get there, Sharon.
Me too.
I went from eternal conscious torment to annihilation for a number of years. I remember we did an episode on this podcast maybe 2 years ago where Steve and I talked about the different views of hell. And I remember then I was very sympathetic to ultimate reconciliation, but I just couldn't get over libertarian free will. That was the thing that was the problem for me. But more and more, I tell you, Thomas Talbot in his book, The Unconditional Love of God, when he talks about free, have you read that book?
Yeah, I have. I read a lot.
Oh, you've read so many books. Yeah, I know it's not instant recall right now. But that book, when he talked about free will and exactly what you said, that our free will, while it is free, there are boundaries. I mean, there's obvious boundaries. We didn't get to choose who we were, you know, what parents we were born to or where we were born or whatever. So obviously there's some limits. So why would God, you know, I've come out of open theism. I've been a big believer in open theism and I'm still there. But one of the things that a lot of the open theists that I just don't resonate with is this idea that God risks everything. So that in the end, God risks the idea that tons of people might reject him and burn forever in hell simply to respect their free will. And I guess when having children myself, it never really hit me until I had boys myself. And in having two little guys, I look at them and I think, would I ever, and simply to honor their free will, would I ever let them run out in the street? No. Would I ever let them play with matches? No, I wouldn't do any of that. So why would God?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So you've come out of the closet on Beyond the Box.
I have. Yeah. How many listeners do you have? I gotta be careful.
That's really, I am totally with you there. Steve and I, really, I did not really give ultimate reconciliation serious thought until I read your book. That's the honest truth. I was sympathetic to it. But when I read your book, I remember telling a friend that I work with that actually listens to the podcast. I remember telling her that your book was the best defense on ultimate reconciliation I'd read, even though in the book you yourself said you didn't believe in universalism at the time. I said, I think that's the best defense. I still wasn't quite ready, but your book was one of the impetuses to get me going in this direction. And since then, after reading things like The Evangelical Universalist and The Unconditional Love of God and some of these books, I went away going, I don't know how you can faithfully believe anything else and still hold true to the idea that God is love.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And requires we love our enemies. Is God going to do any differently?
Exactly. Exactly. Unconditionally. That we have to... Right. I always found that so ironic when I remember even being steeped in all of these different views that we're kind of rejecting now. Mm-hmm. Even in the midst of that, I thought it was so ironic that God would tell me to love, you know, like the 1 Corinthians 13 way, that mm-hmm. I have to be patient and kind and blah, blah, blah. But God can be a pissed off, angry, violent deity, and it's okay.
Taking into account wrongs done against him,
Yeah, I always thought that wasn't fair.
Right.
And then I started realizing 1 Corinthians 13, if God is love, then that actually described how he believed and behaved toward everyone.
That's right.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah, if there's one thing I would change in this raising hell, it would be the fact that I didn't come out there as a universalist.
Yeah.
But I did want to leave options open for people. My Southern Baptist friends, as soon as they hear somebody's a universalist, that's it.
Right. All discussions cut off.
Discussions closed. You're a heretic. Everything else you have to say is totally worthless.
Right.
And so I didn't feel like I could do that in the book. So I wanted to leave it as an option for people. And now I'm kind of sorry that I wasn't honest.
But, you know, in a way, I'm glad you did it the way you did it, because honestly, there's a lot of people that will read your book and make it to the end of the book that never would have if you'd put that in there.
Yeah, that's probably.
And it leads you down the road. I don't know how you can get done reading your book, especially the first time I read it was great. But the second time, and maybe it's because I've since coming to this idea and, you know, doing a lot of research on my own with other theologians, mm-hmm. when I read your book the second time, it just became abundantly obvious that I don't know how you can believe in the idea that God is love, that Jesus revealed God, and that God is nonviolent, and come to any other conclusion.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
You said in Raising Hell, the traditional theory of hell doesn't explain how God deals with evil. It exacerbates evil by keeping the wicked perpetually in existence.
Yeah.
Which I think is one of the absolute best reasons to not believe in the traditional notion of hell. To me, it leaves you with either annihilation or ultimate reconciliation, because if we have a new creation,
right,
wherein we're told only righteousness dwells,
right,
what do you do with that? So, you know, I don't think you're left with an alternative. So I really appreciated that in saying that, you know, I think that's something people don't think of, that when you give this idea of an eternal hell credence, what you're basically saying is that evil exists for eternity.
Yeah, and God keeps it in existence.
And since he's omnipresent, he's standing there right there with it.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
That doesn't make sense.
Well, I really, you've taken so much time. I really appreciate that. I could talk your ear off for another 4 hours, but I'm not going to do that. This is really amazing. I want to ask you just one more question.
Okay.
And this is to help me out. Okay. I've got two little boys, and they're both under the age of 3. Mm-hmm. And being a man myself, being raised on war movies and G.I. Joe and violent video games and all these different things, mm-hmm. I'm really perplexed about, because of the views I have about nonviolence and pacifism, and that's so integral to the gospel and the character of God. How do you raise sons that are healthy and productive members of society, and not weird, without exposing them to all this stuff? How do you raise healthy boys in this kind of environment and the kind of culture we live in?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's different for each child, but I found for me, and mine at this point, have strayed away. Everything was great until they got out of high school. But every morning we would have prayer time, Bible lesson time, reading. I read them the Chronicles of Narnia, you know, before they went to school. And so they have the theology. I mean, their Sunday school teachers hated to see him coming because they would ask questions nobody could answer. And it, well, go home and ask your mother, you know. So they know it, and they have this stuff hidden in their hearts, and I'm hoping they return to it someday. I mean, they're Christians. They just are so turned off from the church, and it's the church that really did them damage. Unfortunately, that's another story. But anyway, yeah. I found that age appropriateness is really important, and I would take things, because I raised my kids in the midst of a lot of fundamentalist homeschoolers. Mm. That are very good friends of mine still, but I only homeschooled for a year each when they were going to be shipped off to the city in order to have sixth grade. But I thought they needed to be in the environment and learn how to deal with it. And so, but what I did with mine was use some of these games, and there were some I wouldn't let them play and some things I wouldn't let them watch until they got older. So there's age appropriateness involved. But they also can be object lessons. If we teach our children that these things are out there, this is what you're going to see, but what might God say about this? How might Jesus respond to this? Okay, they're fun to watch. This is not reality. When you really shoot someone, they die and they're gone. I don't know if you can get that through a kid's mind, but not at your kid's age.
Right, sure.
But as they grow older, and use them as object lessons for how not to behave, or how that might be the way... you have to be careful of sounding real arrogant, and I did when I was raising mine, and I'm sorry about that now. But it was an us versus them mentality, which you don't want to put into them because you want them to love people. But
sure.
Trying to show them that this is the way we do things in the world, but this is not how Jesus would have us live. I banned too much from my children.
Mm.
I wouldn't let them listen to any music but Christian music. They couldn't watch certain shows, which I would still not let them watch certain shows. But I went too far with it.
Yeah.
And so when they got out of high school and they were driving and doing things with friends, it was like, woohoo! You know, we never got to do any. They never even got to trick or treat until they were in high school.
Wow.
I mean, I would change all of that. And I've apologized to them since. Because I think that and the church experience did more to turn them away than draw them in.
See, that's what I've really struggled with is the idea of whether or not to ban certain things. I know there's certain things, obviously, that you should.
Yeah.
But, you know, whether to let them play with G.I. Joes, whether to let them, you know, even at this age, I might sound really ridiculous, I don't know, but even like I remember... One day my wife had Tom and Jerry on. And, you know, I grew up on Tom and Jerry.
Yeah.
And I just started watching that and the Roadrunner and things. And, I mean, just the violent nature of those things. The fact that, you know, you've got Coyote trying to blow up the Roadrunner with dynamite, you know.
And he falls off the cliff and then he gets up and walks around. And that's not...
Exactly. Yeah. And that's not realistic, you know.
Yeah.
But struggling with those ideas of, okay, how do you not make your kids resent you?
Exactly.
And simultaneously protect them and expose them, which seems to be mutually exclusive things. How do you protect them and expose them in a way they should be exposed to the culture, you know? It's just such a hard thing.
It's very, very difficult. And if I were to do it over again, I'd do it totally differently than the way I did because I went too far the other way.
Mm-hmm. So you'd be a little more liberal in what you expose them to.
Yeah, I would want them to see that this is how things are in the world.
Yeah.
But this is how Jesus taught us to be. And Jesus died because of the way he taught and the things he taught and the way he lived. And, you know, so it's not an easy road to walk, but it's the path that leads to life. And so here are things in the world, but this is how Jesus teaches us to be. And not... ban everything from them because some of it's just, this is a cartoon. It's like people don't let their kids read or watch Harry Potter. And I've got a lot of friends who won't let their kids touch that stuff. And I love Harry Potter, you know, and the movie, I have all the videos and that are out. I read the books as soon as they came out, but it's fantasy. And so kids can learn the difference. Maybe not as much when they're three, but when they get a little older, they learn the difference between fantasy and fact.
Mm.
And so they can know that this is a fantasy world that really doesn't happen. And if it did, it wouldn't be the best kind of way to live, but it's not real. Coyotes, you know, or Roadrunner falling off of a cliff and getting back up again is fantasy. That wouldn't really right. happen. This is not real. And so there's a balance there. And, you know, I don't, it's a tough balance to keep.
What you're saying, though, is really empowering because, you know, when I thought about nonviolence and when I've as I've embraced nonviolence and taken a lot of flack for it on this podcast, I might add, I love you guys out there, but you know, it's funny, Sharon, because of all the topics we talk about, of all of these different views of atonement, of all these different views of hell, of all these scripture and inerrancy, all this stuff that we've been talking about over the last 3 years, the thing that we always get the most pushback on, which I welcome it, and I'm thankful that people are willing to talk this out. The thing we get the most pushback on is pacifism by far.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Anyway, in saying that, I just really appreciate what you're saying about object lessons and the idea that it's that your children are going to see it if they're, you know, when they're 18 or older or whatever, they're going to see it. So better for you to let them see it through your eyes.
Right, exactly.
Than to let them see it through, you know, their 16-year-old friend's eyes, yeah. I guess.
And so when they see it, they can identify what's wrong with it.
That's empowering. That really empowers me. I appreciate that. It really does.
Yeah.
Well, before we let you go, I want to just ask you, when your new book's coming out, you said it was next year?
Yes.
Around, so it's going to the publisher, you said around January, so probably maybe middle of next year or something like that?
I imagine the end of the next year.
The end of the next year. Do you have a working title for it?
Well, that's a good question. They wanted to call it Murdering God, Rethinking Everything You've Been Taught About Salvation and the Cross, and I said, I just can't do that.
Hmm.
So it's between Redeeming God, which is what I like, or Executing God. Because, you know, you take the different senses of those words.
Yeah.
Because is God an executioner, or are we executing a study of God and what that means, salvation in the cross? So,
Wow. I really like that. And I got to say, I am so stoked that I'm getting an advanced read of that.
Yeah, you don't even know. You'll email me to remind me, though. So.
I definitely will. You don't have to worry about that.
Okay, good.
What other kind of projects do you have in the works, or how can people, is there a place that people can go to find out more about you or to get in touch with what you're doing with the upcoming projects you have?
Yeah, they can Google my name and find me on email that way.
Okay.
They can, and I get a lot of emails, most of them very positive. And I always try to respond to all of my emails. I think if people take the time to write, I can take the time to respond. And then I've got more. I mean, there's more coming after this atonement book. I want to write a book about, is Jesus the answer, the only answer? And if so, how? If not, you know, what place does Jesus have in the salvation of the world? And, you know, I get accused of being a pluralist, and I'm not. So,
yeah. Well, you said Christian universalist.
Christian universalist.
That's an important adjective, and I'm with you there.
Yeah, it's very important.
Well, if you will hold the line for just a moment, we're gonna go ahead and cut it off, I guess. And
okay.
I thank you so much. You just don't know how much I've enjoyed this time. It has been really
fun.
Enlightening for me, and hopefully we can do it again sometime down the road. And
sure, I enjoyed it. Thank you for asking me.
Kicking around some more ideas. Thank you so much, Sharon. Guys, appreciate y'all listening, and make sure to leave your comments on the podcast.
Wow.
Ray,
yeah, there's a lot
there.
Awesome, man.
There's
yeah.
a lot there, man.
Boy, a lot. But man, these two episodes have just been phenomenal. I joked before we started recording this final bumper that from now on, I'm just going to let you do interviews and I'll record bumpers with you. not that I don't want to participate in the discussion, but man, this has just been fun.
It really has. It really has. I just thoroughly, once again, Sharon, if you're listening, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. We really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you, Sharon, and I thank you for being really nice to my brother, Ray.
Yes, absolutely. And, I mean, how much nicer can you get than the fact that I'm going to get an advanced copy of the Atonement book?
I know.
I am so pumped up about
that,
brother.
That's great.
I mean, yeah. I have literally been, I can't even tell you, Steve, working at a bookstore, you know, if you have a little dead time, you start checking on when is this book coming out and,
yeah.
you know, can I get an advanced copy or whatever? And lo and behold, when she told me her Atonement book wasn't going to be out until late 2012, I was so bummed because I've really been looking forward to that book for like a year now, ever since I read in Raising Hell that she was coming out with it. So to hear that I'm going to get an advanced copy, I am just on cloud nine about that.
That's sweet. And of course, you'll share that with your co-host.
Well, you know, there for a minimal fee, I would be happy.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to go interview somebody and not share their stuff with you. No, that's great. Oh. But boy, I'll tell you what, there's not a whole lot that I even want to say in conclusion to this because I think it really speaks for itself. But man, what a terrific set of topics that you guys covered. And, you know, rabbit trails included. It was so true to Beyond the Box. I love it. Sharon just fit right in with the whole format and concept and everything.
Well, I thought to myself, Steve, when we were about 20 or 30 minutes into our conversation, and I had not asked pretty much a single question that I'd planned on asking, I all of a sudden was like, I really hope she's okay with that. And that's why I told her, I said, you didn't realize that you actually were appearing on rabbittrailpodcast.com.
That's right. Yeah. She seemed to get a kick out of that,
oh,
too.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that was fun. I hope you, our listeners, have enjoyed this as much as we have. This has been a neat, somewhat of an experiment, actually, for Beyond the Box, but just a neat time of
I had never even recorded a Skype conversation before this. I mean, I experimented on my mom the night before, but a couple nights before. But other than that, and on a friend, I experimented maybe a week before. But,
that's
you know,
great.
We're...
Yeah,
we're just really,
it turned out great. I thought it was tremendous quality too. That was a lot of fun.
We're really
just out of curiosity, were you Skyping to her landline?
Yeah,
or was
Skyping
she on
to her
Skype?
Landline? Yeah, Skyping to her landline.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah. I was really tickled with how it came out, and you know, it really opens up a new medium for you and I. The fact that we want to continue everything that we've been doing with our conversations, but you know, just every now and then to supplement an interview and put somebody's voice in there that. Maybe you and I are like, you know how we've been going down all of these trails that Sharon and I covered during the interview.
Right.
You and I have covered all those things. And I love the idea of you and I fleshing some things out and then being able to say, hey, let's get somebody else that maybe can give us a fresh perspective on this on the podcast and hear what they have to say. Just really, really neat.
It's a lot of fun. And you and I do intend at some point in the near future to do a follow-up episode to this conversation, because there's just so much that she brought out that we want to talk again about and to go even further with. But once again, thank you all for joining us. Thank you, Sharon Baker, for being a delightful first guest on Beyond the Box.
Yeah.
We really appreciate and enjoy that. And thanks to our listeners for joining us for these two episodes, and I really do hope that this has been as fun for you guys as it has been for us. I enjoyed listening to it, Ray. I know you enjoyed doing the interview. You emailed me like a little kid in a candy store after it was over, going, "Oh man, it was so much fun." She was a terrific guest, and it just what a dare I use this word? What an inspired conversation.
Yeah,
I think the voice of God was all over your conversation, and.
Yeah,
it was just so much fun to listen to that stuff and go, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
So much of it resonated with me. I sound like I'm just gushing over a celebrity. I don't mean it to sound that way, but I'm just thrilled that we had the opportunity to do this. I'm thrilled that Sharon was willing to participate and being so free with her time as well to give us two complete episodes. But if you'd like to comment on this, any kind of comment, criticism, question, follow-up, we mentioned last time that, you know, Sharon may be able to answer some follow-up questions if we have any. But you can do that through our website, beyondtheboxpodcast.com, or on Facebook, great place to jump into conversation with us. Feel free to post your own questions and comments there, facebook.com/beyondthebox. Or if you can do it in 140 characters or less, twitter.com/BTB podcast. I always feel like I have to say that slowly because I want people to understand the letters that I'm saying. It's short for Beyond the Box, which makes sense, but BTB podcast. It's one of the more unique URLs that we have to use.
And Steve, you know, I want to encourage our listeners too that, you know, maybe you don't want to post something out there for everyone to see. Maybe you're a little apprehensive about that.
That's a great
feel
point,
free to email us directly. If you just do Ray at beyondtheboxpodcast.com or Steve at beyondtheboxpodcast.com, or you can even just do Beyond the Box Podcast at beyondtheboxpodcast.com.
Yes, that's right. And there's actually a form on our website, too, that you can fill out, and it'll send directly to us if you go to beyondtheboxpodcast.com. I think it's called Contact Us.
I think that's right at the moment.
There's a page there that has a form you can fill out, and it's basically just a way to email us directly without using email. Next time on Beyond the Box, we will either take up some conversation related to this interview, or we'll touch on another topic, but I guarantee you it'll be a time you don't want to miss. Ray, I look forward to getting back into the co-host chair with you.
Absolutely, and, brother.
Glad to know that my job wasn't completely wiped out there by Ms. Baker.
Hey, your job is always secure as long as I'm here, brother.
I appreciate that. I appreciate you.
Five years of conversation doesn't go away overnight.
Boy, it sure doesn't, does it? And it doesn't go away very easily when we're trying to record short bumpers either. We'll let y'all go for now. Join us next time on Beyond the Box.